Well, I have a wonderful electronic invention I want you to see. It looks something like this.
What's up, Curiosity Builders? I'm Chris Martin, and you're listening to Getting Work to Work, a weekly podcast for creative entrepreneurs and leaders looking to grow, not only by learning new things, but by connecting their work to big ideas and overcoming the barriers that prevent them from doing the work they were born to do. In today's interview episode of Getting Work to Work, I talk with Lizzie LaRocque, a positive psychology creativity coach and photographer, about her reverence for the creative process, the importance of play, and breaking free from the day's expectations in order to see awe-inspiring, creativity-inducing moments. We dive deep into permission, perfectionism, rejection, failure, as well as curiosity's connection to mindfulness. Show notes and links for this episode can be found at gwtw.co/260. Lizzie, welcome to Getting Work to Work. Why don't you share a little bit about who you are and the work you do?
Well, thanks for having me, Chris. I'm so excited to be here.
Yeah.
And I am Lizzie LaRocque. I am a positive psychology-based creativity coach. And I know that's a mouthful. I haven't come up with a better title yet. But basically, it just means that I coach people, and then I also lead workshops both online and in person. And I use photography to integrate positive psychology concepts into people's lives.
That's awesome. And one of the things that's fascinating is, based upon your website and what you just described, you've really kind of pruned how you describe yourself, because on your website, you're a photographer / writer / creativity leader / storyteller / coach. And that's a lot of slashes. So would you say that the positive psychology is really the thread that weaves through all those things?
Well, you know, I think the positive psychology is, but more that story is the thread. I know that you had mentioned that in our conversations. Are you a storyteller? And it's not a separate hat that I wear. It's the umbrella for all of it. You know, photos are visual stories, and I use stories in my writing to persuade or entertain. And in coaching, we use stories as well, but it's a little different. You know, we flip the stories. We sort of identify the stories that, you know, we might have been telling ourselves our entire lives that are holding us back. And we flip those on their head and try to figure out a new narrative. And, you know, it's sort of with each aspect, writing, photography, and coaching, and creativity in general, it's that, you know, it's that blank canvas. It's that opportunity to write that next chapter of what do you want to focus on? So I think that's an additional thread, but I'm trying to get better about editing it down. I probably have 10 more titles I could adopt.
I love the idea of not only storytelling, but editing as a form of storytelling. Cause that's really interesting, because I find a simultaneous drive to write that next chapter at the same time as editing the current chapter and, you know, wanting to forget the previous chapter.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, and I always say, like, in writing, you know, don't write with a red pen. You've got to write first. You've got to be, you know, really prolific first, then you edit. And it's the same with photography, you know, with digital photography, especially these days, it costs you nothing to take a whole bunch of photos. We joke that to be a good photographer means you are a good editor. You don't show people the hundreds that didn't work out. You show them the one that did. It's funny too, because when you're telling your life story, I mean, you could share an experience from your life and just share all the bad parts, and that would be one edit, or you could edit it with the good parts or the hero's journey of both, bringing them together. So it's stories aren't, I guess they aren't always honest or factual. They can be changed depending on what point you want to make.
Right. Well, how have you learned to kind of identify which story needs to be told in which moment?
Oh, God, that's a good question. I'm not sure I have identified. It's more that experience of from the heat, you know, like I like to say that I write from the heat. So if something's really just loud in my brain that needs to be expressed, that's the choice that needs to be made.
Yeah.
Same with photography. You know, I am much more, I am not as much of a planner, you know, like a landscape photographer might really study the light and study an area for days before they go out and commit to sitting for like 5 hours, or an animal photographer where they're waiting for that perfect moment. And I am much more of the sort of spontaneous serendipity, like as I'm moving throughout the world, when something catches my eye, I honor that and stop for it.
Mm. What a cool picture of, like, you're riding from that heat of that passion that's inside, but also being willing to stop and observe and take in those things that maybe you aren't seeing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's been kind of the crux of my work, of just, you know, where are we on autopilot, and where are we just like asleep to kind of the art and the everyday, or what's going on in the world around us. I'm a big mindfulness practitioner. Mm-hmm. So it's what drives me a lot is that noticing, not ignoring, not tunnel visioning, like on your way to work or whatever that narrowed point of view is, and really notice what's around you, because there's a lot of cool stuff.
Yeah. It's interesting that you mentioned mindfulness, because I'm reading a book right now called Wired to Create.
Oh, okay.
And it's about how our brain functions in different aspects of creativity. Mm-hmm. And this morning I was reading about mindfulness, and that we need to be operating between mindfulness and mindlessness, but not letting our brain fully be in one mode or the other, but kind of existing between those two worlds. So we're being present on what we're doing, but at the same time allowing our minds to wander.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, the practice of meditation or mindfulness is really strengthening that muscle of, I mean, in addition to all the sort of enlightened aspects to it, but the neurology of it is strengthening that focus muscle and learning how to bring your mind back in. But a big component to creativity is that ability to daydream and like drift off and make, you know, connections between disparate concepts. So I completely agree that it's, you know, there's the focus practice, and then there's also the just let yourself sort of get curious and follow that curiosity.
Yeah. So when we first met, you told me a story about running a 200-seat restaurant / bar / nightclub, and how that really burnt you out. And what did you learn from that experience that you'll never forget as you work as a coach / dot, dot, dot?
/ 20 other things. I learned that I will never add restaurant owner back to my slashes. How about that?
That's excellent.
That, you know, I was thinking as you were just saying that, and having like a PTSD reaction to even thinking about the 200 seat restaurant and bar. And, you know, I did that for 14 years. So that's a pretty long time. I joke that I could write the reverse book on how to not do it. How to, here are all the things not to do in your restaurant ownership by Lizzie LaRock. And it would probably be several volumes long. I think I, you know, made multiple mistakes in that time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the overarching theme that led to my burnout was that I was really trying to control the uncontrollable. And I was terrible at listening and honoring my gut. And in my coach training, which I did my coach training while I still owned the restaurant, I trained with Martha Beck, and she's really funny. And what she used to say was, your mind is a two-bit whore. And that's, you know, kind of just a more irreverent way of saying, you know, the mind is a wonderful servant, but a terrible master. And you know, I took it to mean that my mind really could easily sell me out. And I talked myself back into that restaurant for most of the 14 years that I owned it. I mean, I can't pick a year out where I thought, oh, every day I was really just excited to do this work. I wasn't. I knew from the beginning that it wasn't for me. And I just kept forcing myself into this situation that didn't work for me, you know, on so many different levels. you know, I wanted to be fired, but I was the only one who could fire me. So I wish I could say, Chris, that, oh, you know, I learned that lesson so neatly and it was really mm-hmm. tidy. And after that, I just always listened to my gut and I just moved about in the world much better. But I definitely let that pattern play out a few more times before I really got it. So in my current iteration, if it doesn't feel good in my gut, if my intuition is speaking loudly, I listen. I listen a lot more than I ever did.
It's interesting to think of listening not only as what we're hearing from other people, but hearing from within.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm curious as to how you've really worked on being aware of what you're feeling or thinking inside.
Oh, well, you know, I am a slow learner. Apparently I had to go through like a ton of TMJ and migraines, mm-hmm. like terrible headaches mm-hmm. and jaw pain. And I would sit in meetings with clients. This was after the restaurant. And I would sit in meetings with clients in marketing work that I was doing. And I would just all of a sudden start to feel this giant lump in the back of my head getting, and it wasn't a lump. It just was where my headaches and jaw pain would manifest. And I just would start to notice like, that's weird. I felt really good before I walked in here. And now I'm noticing that my head feels like it's ready to explode as it's so I've tried to be much better at listening to those, noticing those subtleties mm-hmm. within my own body. But I think that when you let your burnout get really bad, as I did, you can experience quite a lot of physical pain. And it's a good barometer, I guess you could say, for making decisions. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's about where my listening goes.
Yeah. Burnout is really interesting because it's something that I think we're going to see more and more of as we get more in touch with technology and how we can do more things with technology. And I'm wondering how you work with people to really start working through burnout.
Yeah, I completely agree. I was actually thinking about kind of, you know, my own priorities, and I love being a digital entrepreneur and I love being flexible in my work that I can go pick up my kids from school or mm-hmm. travel, but it's that slippery slope and that conundrum of just being tethered to a device 24/7. Mm-hmm. And there's one thing that my own chiropractor has worked on with me is that sort of mobile phone neck. Like as you're leaning forward and your head weighs quite a bit, it starts to really weigh on you. The way my mindfulness practice had always worked is that I try to be really good, not perfect by any means on this, but try to practice like a digital sunset, like turning off at a certain time of night, and mm-hmm. a digital Sabbath, like taking a whole day off. I'm probably not at the point of a weekly digital Sabbath, but like twice mm-hmm. a month. With people, one component is really helping everyone understand that, you know, the more that we're connected to our devices, the more our amygdala is engaged and the more easily it can be hijacked. So we already have a pretty overzealous amygdala, but when we're constantly getting dings and notifications, you just, everything becomes that startle response and that overreaction. It's definitely not great for our creativity. I'll tell you that much. So I think that when a lot of my clients kind of have a better understanding of the science behind it, like I'm not just a jerk. Nobody's a jerk. We just tend to overreact. Like I joke that you know, we all have the negativity bias of mm-hmm. that's kept us alive for thousands of years, that we would be vigilant and aware of a tiger around every corner, but now we're looking for tigers at Starbucks. There's no tiger there. It might be a tiger mom, but not a tiger. So it's just changing our understanding that, you know, our own our own bodies and brains need a software upgrade to be in today's world without constantly having our limbic system running the show.
Yeah.
Did I answer that? I'm not sure if I answered that question.
Absolutely. Which it kind of, your answer leads me into this next idea of, you know, work-life integration. And I don't think we're in an era anymore where it's about work-life balance. I like the idea of this integration. And I'm curious, how does that work-life integration play into your software updates for your brain?
Yeah. So, well, I know, as you know, before we hit record, we were just talking about where I live. I live in a ski town, and I've lived in a ski town in Colorado for 22 years. And as I was sharing with you about a lot of the crazy snowstorms and avalanches we experienced last week, you know, it's not an easy place to live. It's expensive. It's like winter is long. We get a ton of snow. We're 3 hours from the Denver airport, from like a major airport. And when I first moved here, there was like nowhere to get a haircut or buy underwear or any of the basics in life. So you know, one thing that I appreciate about living here is that it's a very playful town. You know, we enjoy a lot of skiing. We enjoy a lot of hiking. We do a ton outdoors. And if I don't participate in those things, like, I may as well be back in Detroit where I grew up, where probably a lot less expensive and a little bit easier to survive on a day-to-day basis.
Right.
So it's one part is that it's sort of the work-life integration is already built into the culture around here. You know, people work a lot, but they also play a lot. And then the other component is that, just as I was talking about with the amygdala hijacking and really affecting our own, you know, well-being, and more importantly for my work, the creative process, I'm really, like, I have a very deep reverence and understanding of my creative process. And I know that if you, I don't know, if the movie The Shining terrified you as much as it terrified me as a small child, there's that, like, all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy scene. And I've, you know, apply that to myself, like, all work and no play makes me not only dull, but really irritable. If I'm tethered to my device 14 days in a row and I'm working till 10 o'clock at night, everything I try to do, writing, photography, teaching, it's like a fish swimming through Jell-O. It doesn't work. It takes so much longer, and, you know, the ideas don't flow. So it's counterintuitive. You know, you think, like, the harder you work or the longer you work, the more you can produce. And I have found that after that burnout, after migraines and everything that I went through in my body, that it's just like the playtime, the rest, meditation, unplugging are really integral to me being able to do what I do and do what I do without, you know, feeling like it's like the slowest molasses process of all time.
Wow. I like that a lot, not only because of what you shared about, you know, play is so important, but now I'm imagining you running through your ski town packed with snow with an axe chasing people. So.
Yes. And you know that the movie was filmed only like 2 hours away. So you're like, I could really relate to some of that cabin fever, psychotic feelings at times. So yeah.
Another thing that you said that was really fascinating was you have reverence for your creative process. And how did you learn to discover that reverence? Is that something that came natural to you, or is it something that you discovered as you healed on that journey of burning out to, you know, being who you are today?
Yeah, it was not at all something that I ever realized until I was healing, because that burnout for sure came from the never unplugging, never detaching from work. And I was also married to my business partner. So my husband and I, you know, we'd fall into bed at night and still be talking about the nightmare that was our day. So there was no separation. And my own stress level reached a pretty toxic level at some point before we finally sold the restaurant that we owned. And in that time is when I really discovered mindfulness. I had learned about mindfulness. I knew about mindfulness. Just a newsflash here, Chris. You can't actually benefit from mindfulness unless you actually practice it. So I had read I'd read all the books on it, but I actually had never participated in actually doing the work. So I finally, started actively practicing it. And I would notice, like, oh my God, I went for a walk today and I came up with 30 ideas. And they came so fast that I actually had to, you know, yell at Siri or get out my phone, you know, the notes app on my phone to start quickly writing things down so I wouldn't forget them. And I would notice that, oh my gosh, I sat at my desk for 4 hours and like nothing happened. And I just felt terrible. And then I got up and moved around and all of a sudden, you know, things started flowing. One in particular was I was on an advisory committee for our tourism bureau here, and the public relations director had asked me for some help. And I kind of like put the ideas in my head of what she needed help with. And then I went to sleep that night and I had one of those wonderful experiences where I woke up like at 5 a.m. with a million ideas for her. And all I had done was gone to bed. I was like, boy, that's a lot easier. Like, how do I harness this a bit more? So I just started studying it. And the, you know, positive psychology has been a huge boon to that. You know, we learned in my certification process that, you know, you experience brain drain after 20 minutes of sitting at your desk. Brain-derived neurotrophic factor goes down, your BDNF, and that if you just jump up and move around a little bit, it starts to increase. So I think I just started to put the clues together and then learned about the science behind it and then decided, okay, I actually can legitimately honor this now, this creative process, and I can say, I need to take a break because that's better for my brain. I don't think if I didn't have the science, I probably, you know, my brain, the two-bit whore, would have said, no, 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 get back to work, back to the grind.
Got to make your money.
Slave driver, totally.
So you've mentioned positive psychology a couple of times. What is the simplest way to describe that? Because in my mind, you know, it's like, you know, the power of positive thinking and things like that. So, yes. You know, how would you describe positive psychology?
So positive psychology, it's actually a rigorous scientific study of well-being and of flourishing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, traditional psychology is focused on the disease model. And there's nothing wrong with traditional psychology, but it's what it's become today is very focused on getting people from below baseline to baseline. Mm-hmm. And positive psychology is about optimal living, but it's getting people north of neutral, so north of that baseline. And it's not happyology. It's not saying, you know, the goal is to be deliriously happy 24/7. Like, that would be its own diagnosed problem in its own right. So a few of the highlights to it are sort of gratitude and mindfulness, savoring, meaning, fulfillment, purpose. The way that I came through it is through resilience, really. It's that ability to bend instead of break and to know that life will get all lifey on us, for a made-up adjective for you. And perfect. How do we learn to be resilient through that process? And really, truly, a meaningful life includes growth. It's not meant to just be, you know, like I always joke, I'm not going to regale my great grandchildren with stories of me watching Netflix on the couch. The stories that I want to share with them are ones that, you know, weren't always the easiest thing, that maybe had a little bit of a hero's journey to them.
So bend, not break. Life is lifey.
Yeah.
Like, and then you've got gratitude, gravy, right brain, resolution, revolution. Okay. What is it about alliteration that not only do you adore, but you naturally go there in conversation?
Oh my God. That just makes me laugh so hard. It's like, I don't think anyone's ever noticed my love of alliteration, or no one's pointed it out to me. Probably people have noticed it. And so I love music and I love poetry. And I think the alliteration really kind of naturally each word slides into the next if it starts with the same letter. I have my name is both my married name and my maiden name are both alliterative. I don't even know what the word would be. I was born Lizzie Loud and I married, my name became Lizzie LaRock. So that's probably, it's just a very vain ode to myself. No, in all seriousness, I really do. I love having irreverent, fun names. If I were to teach a class called How to Say Thank You, I don't think my enthusiasm would be as high around it or with the right brain resolution revolution, you know, how to meet your goals. I just, I love to have that playful, lyrical component to it. And it just, it gets me all excited. So I think I convey that to the people that I'm teaching and that draws them in as well.
Well, and what's great about it too, is when you are lit for what you're doing, when Lizzie LaRock is lit, she is able to, you know, draw people in. So as a teacher, that's so necessary.
Yeah. Yeah. So it sounds selfish, but it's necessary, right?
Yeah. That's awesome. So let's talk about the Life Feast. What is this online course about? Because you just launched it, right?
I did. Well, I just finished my first round of it about a week ago, and then I just launched the second version of it. So it's just, you know, I'm really experienced now, Chris. No. But yeah, it's my hybrid class for adults of how to bring in positive psychology and integrate it into your life using photography. So it's kind of about, you know, what we were talking about earlier of my art in the everyday, of noticing what's, you know, all the creativity around us that we might be disregarding. And there's I use this fantastic Pablo Picasso quote in a lot of my sales materials for this, that it's, you know, art washes away from the soul the dust of everyday life. And I love that quote because I just think that with every mortgage payment, with every phone bill, with every, you know, I don't know, snow shoveling situation, we get dusty. And I think that I love that he sort of articulated that art is a way that undoes that from us. It's like, you know, I don't know, like a little can of Pledge or something that you're dusting yourself off. So I love teaching, especially a lot of my peers. You know, I have kids that are now, I have twins that are 13 years old. And I know that from when my kids were really little till about, you know, 5 years ago or so, I was just exhausted and really busy. And, you know, kind of wake up like a decade later and there's that Talking Heads song, that, you know, how did I get here? It's the, you know, looking at your life and wondering, how did I get that beautiful wife? Oh, anyway, that's my musical interlude to Talking Heads. But that was kind of the catalyst for it, of just wondering, where did my personality go? You know, I'm driving my kids to all these fantastic activities, to piano lessons and to dance and theater. And these are all things that I want to be doing. And I'm just sitting in the car waiting for them, or I'm just paying the bills, or I'm filling out the permission slips and kind of just making this a big permission slip to adults that we're allowed to go out and create. And, you know, I recently, one of my first Life Feasters had said, encourage them to take artistic photos on their phones. And she said, it never occurred to me to take a photo of anything other than my children. And this has been so much fun to see the art in the everyday. So that's kind of the genesis of it all. Mm-hmm.
One of the things that really struck me when I was reading the description is that it's for people who have forgotten how to be creative. Yeah. And that really hit me hard because it's so easy, I think, to forget to be creative or even how to be creative. And so why do we forget that? Is it just because we're driving from here to there and doing all the things for other people and not ourselves? Or is it something deeper?
I think it's all of that. I mean, in addition, you know, there's that old, I know since you're a computer coding nerd as well, you know, there's that that term that garbage in, garbage out, you know, GIGO. Like you've got your garbage in code, you get garbage out, you know, mm-hmm. code. So if we stuff our faces with, and I'm just as guilty as the next guy, but the, you know, stuffing our faces with Facebook and Instagram, and we never give ourselves that chance to be bored or to daydream or to make those connections. If we're just feeding our muse like McDonald's, then we're not going to feel all that creative. I think that there are so many ways to seek out pleasure right now. You know, you've got Netflix, you've got, you know, I grew up with like three TV channels. So this is now that's there any number of ways that you can just numb yourself to what's going on. And I think that that's a big problem. We've become, you know, complacent, and that has affected our creativity quite a bit. And then as we were talking about earlier with that, the amygdala hijacking, you know, one aspect of positive psychology that I always resonate with is that, you know, we try to understand like, what's the point of positive emotions? And mm-hmm. we know that negative emotions narrow and focus us. You know, they keep us hyper alert of that tiger, and we're narrowed and focused to run, fight or flight. But the mm-hmm. positive emotions, the point of them is that they broaden and build us. And they, you know, they build upon each other, and they lead to more creativity. So I think that as we allow ourselves to just live more stressed out lives in our negative emotions, narrow and focused, that also affects our creativity. So when you do practice gratitude, or you take a moment to soak in awe around you, or you're more playful, you are more creative. You're tapping into the power of those positive emotions. And those were really important for our survival as well. You know, we don't acknowledge them, but, you know, inventing fire, like tools, a lot of that came out of the, you know, the creativity that we had and the curiosity.
So what would you say are the courses to the meal that is the life feast?
Well, let's see. You can take the girl out of the restaurant, right? But you can't take exactly. the restaurant out of the girl. What we do in there is there's the art of seeing, there's slowing down, there's going into flow, a flow state. There's savoring, which I refer to as kind of like mindfulness on steroids. It's really appreciating what you're being mindful of. And then I get people to be a lot more playful and to experiment and use their curiosity. And then we go into leaving your comfort zone, because I think that's the growth part, that we assume that life should just be really comfortable and we're just after the holy grail of happiness, and we're really not. You know, we're after meaning and fulfillment, and that comes from growth, that comes from leaving our comfort zone. Mm-hmm. And then we end the final course is awe, just really having reverence for, you know, this wonderful thing called awe in the everyday, awe for an artistic performance, or awe from the top of a mountain. There are all kinds of awe-inspiring events in our lives that we might not notice. And I end with awe and the exercise, you know, throughout the whole life feast, all of the exercises are about using your camera to integrate. And then with awe, it's actually we're putting the camera away, and we're just being present and noticing, taking it in first, so that we're not affecting the experience of awe. There's a funny cartoon from the New Yorker of, here's a picture of us taking a picture of the thing we're supposed to be noticing.
Right.
So I tell a story about my photography teacher in college. Did a project, and this was back in the film days, back in the dark ages or the dark room days. And he had done a project at the Grand Canyon, taking pictures of tourists taking pictures of the Grand Canyon. They weren't noticing the Grand Canyon. They were just noticing it through their screen. So it's a photography class where where we spend a lot of the time taking pictures and then noticing when the camera is getting in the way of our life experience. Yeah.
And what's interesting is, like, I love that idea of awe and ending with awe, because as you were talking, I'm like, oh yeah.
Yeah.
You know,
exactly.
And just kind of thinking about just being present in a moment and how our phones not only expand a moment, but actually can take away from a moment as well. And I was at a concert recently where I was really trying to balance that, wanting to document it so that I could remember it in the future, but also being present so that I can enjoy it in the moment.
Yeah, I was, that's funny you brought up a concert, because I was just thinking of an experience that I share in the awe module, spoiler, but that I had seen Peter Frampton in concert last summer. And I thought it was really incredible. I guess he was notorious for having thrown a audience member's phone when they were a few years ago. Wasn't that well received. He was frustrated with all the phones and told the person to put their phone away, and they didn't. And so then he threw it. So later on, he finessed his messaging a little bit around it. But it was really wonderful. You went into the concert and he said, in his, you know, beautiful British accent, you can take photos during the first three songs and then that's it. Then put your phone away for the rest of it. We're all going to be here together and enjoy this experience. And it was amazing, because it, you know, was not allowed. You were allowed to get that moment for, oh yeah, I remember I saw Peter Frampton and, you know, one of his 20 guitars. And then you weren't allowed to, you know, the rest of it, you were just in the experience. It was, for someone who is a photographer, like, it was a relief to go, oh, that's not even allowed. I have to be present.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Wow. That there's something powerful in that too. Like, we almost need the three song maximum for our life too.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Like, what's my three song rule for everything I'm experiencing?
Fortunately, I'm into progressive rock, so three songs is an hour and a half.
You're like, that's the whole show.
I win.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, that's cheating, Chris.
No, not at all. It's called art. So what's one thing that we can do right now to instantly be more creative?
One thing would just be just to move around. I mean, it's that BDNF. I feel like once I put the pieces together on noticing that in my own life and then hearing the science behind it, I mean, it really is. I think it was Nietzsche that's like, I don't trust any ideas that didn't come from a walk. Like, just go for a walk. It's. I'm sure I'm butchering that, but it's something along those lines. But I mean, really just get up and move. And during that walk, you know, I try to make the rule. It's like that three song rule. I love podcasts. And if I'm listening to a podcast that's inspiring me, it's just for half of the walk. And then the other half has to be in silence so that I'm processing and coming up with my own ideas. That's one of the easiest ways to get creative right away. So my English professor in college was this wonderful man named Dr. Consolo. And he actually was kind of the main inspiration for the character in Dead Poets Society that Robin Williams plays as a teacher. So he was, as I said, by the time I had him as a teacher, he was like 75 years old. So he wasn't jumping on desks and you know, reading poetry to us from the top of his desk. But what he did do every day is he'd come into class and he'd be like, I walked backwards uphill a mile to get here. And you'd see this man, and people who didn't take his classes were like, who is this crazy guy who's walking? You know, the college was in Ohio. It was at the top of this hill. And he would walk straight up backwards for a mile, you know, not self-conscious at all, and would come in so revved up and excited and inspired. And, you know, I'm sure it made him more creative. I mean, I was only 22 years old at the time, so I just mostly thought it was nuts. But but you figure if you're changing your perspective and you're doing the same, you know, the same, our brain loves novelty, right? Like, it lights up like Vegas when we're seeing something new. So even just taking a similar thing and flipping your perspective on it by walking backwards.
Yeah.
And then, you know, in photography, we do that with, like, just you know, getting down lower, taking a worm's eye view photo or a bird's eye view. Like, don't take everything straight on at eye level. That's how we see things every day. Change your perspective. Focus on something unexpected. So if you apply that into your daily life, you know, it'll definitely feed your creativity. Walk backwards at your own risk, though. I should have like a legal disclaimer. Not into traffic, not into.
How did you know I was thinking about that?
You're gonna have we don't want a lawsuit on our hands here.
Exactly. Oh, that's great. Like, it's interesting because, like, in the photography film world, the craze is drones,
you know,
and being able to get up high and look down. And it's just like, but we forget to lay down on the ground, to get dirty, to look up.
Yeah. And we become, you know, it's sort of that when you see everyone and their brother has a drone and their footage from it. I mean, you just become sort of desensitized. That becomes the common viewpoint, right? So it was so interesting at first because most of us hadn't seen that perspective. Mm-hmm. So yeah, just twirl around, get all over the place. A favorite mentor of mine used to say, "If you think you're close enough, get closer. Like, just keep going." And you know, the drone shot is really interesting and takes that wide angle, but then the macro is really interesting too. So it's that balance of, do both.
One of the things that was really impactful when I was reading a lot about photography when I was first starting out was the idea of the difference between like a close-up with a lens versus the close-up with your body.
And
how, you know, putting a telephoto lens means that you don't have to be integrated into the action. You can be an observer and distant of it. But if you wanted to really have that close-up experience with like a 50 millimeter lens or an 18 millimeter lens, you literally had to be in the action.
Yes, absolutely. I love that expression. It's, you know, I think it's something like, hey, your best zoom lens is your legs. Get in there. And, you know, as far as the connection with positive psychology, like if you're getting up closer to say a person, our relationships matter in life, right? So it is creating that connection. Sometimes it can be obtrusive and doesn't, you know, you have to be really cognizant of using your curiosity to engage the person rather than just trying to snap the photo and run away.
You know, right.
It's a much more personalized experience. So I love that you pointed that out, that, you know, get up closer, be really intimate with your subject for lack of a better word.
Well, a close-up is really intimate.
Yeah.
And it's something to where when you have that level of trust to not only get up close, but to bring out emotion when you're that close. I mean, that takes time, that takes intention, that takes more than just a fancy camera.
Absolutely. And it's creating, you know, less of that barrier. Like if you were shooting from far away, sort of in that sniper mode, like, you know, you get to be not vulnerable and protected. Yeah. And, you know, again, that's kind of, you're not getting in there and seeing the growth that can happen. Mm-hmm. Leaving your comfort zone. It's very uncomfortable to take a photo of a picture of someone up close that you might not know very well. That's definitely a great leave your comfort zone personal experiment. I always joke, like, you know, when I teach the leaving your comfort zone, I've talked about, you know, I've paraglided or ziplined. And you're like, those things actually weren't that scary. Like getting up close to a stranger, that can be a lot scarier than hurling yourself off of a cliff.
So a lot of what you're describing, and you've mentioned it as well, is just this idea of curiosity, you know, curiosity in your surroundings, curiosity in other people. Apart from what you've already shared, have you discovered anything about curiosity that most people either don't know or maybe don't believe?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I don't know. I'd be interested in hearing, you know, your thoughts on sort of misconceptions about curiosity that I think a lot of people just don't pay as much attention to what a benefit it could be in their life. But you think about, you know, I've been married for over 20 years. And when we sort of just assume we know all there is to know about a number, another human being, that isn't always what gets us all revved up to be around that person. But when we approach yeah. them with curiosity and what do they think about a certain subject matter? I mean, it's much better for our relationships. And I love Ellen Langer. She's a mindfulness researcher out of Harvard. And she had this really cool, I hadn't made the connection, I guess, myself prior to putting a lot of the content together for the Life Feast between curiosity and mindfulness. And, you know, when I've taught mindfulness in the past, people sort of like tune out, like, oh God, don't, I'm not closing my eyes in front of you. Or, you know, just like, I had someone actually say that, like, I don't close my eyes in public. And, you know, people get really intimidated by it. That sounds so highbrow, esoteric. Like, do I need to wear finger chimes? And thinking, it's really a lot simpler. So in Ellen Langer's study that I really loved was she had these dolphin trainers, and she had two sets of dolphin trainers. One set were given instructions to be really curious about the dolphins that they were going to be swimming with. And then the other set of dolphin trainers were supposed to just think about rote facts that they had memorized about the dolphins, like how much they weighed and, you know, how big they grow. And the other one was supposed to just notice new things about the pod, new things about the way they swam, any new things. And so then they tested the two different groups, and the dolphins that were with the more curious bunch, which in her research, they were saying that that was a way to kind of invoke more mindfulness into the situation, that those dolphins swam longer, jumped higher, like they were much more connected to the trainers than the trainers who had memorized the rote facts. So I love that approach of just being not only curious about our surroundings, like, you know, making art out of the everyday, but being more curious in our relationships to bring us closer to other people.
Right. And I love that connection to mindfulness as well, because then it brings curiosity to ourselves.
Yeah.
I mean, we live with other people for, you know, being married for, you know, 15 years, 20 years, but also we're with ourselves, you know, all the time. But you know, getting curious, not in a narcissistic sense, but in a sense of just like, well, what do I actually think about this? Or how do I feel about this?
Right. And is this thought moving me forward or is it holding me back? Like, what, you know, do I have to believe this one? What's another way of looking? Yeah. You don't have to believe everything you think. And, you know, what's another way of looking at this situation that's bringing me down? You know, probably if I had used more curiosity in my restaurant years, you know, that probably would have staved off burnout in some instances, you know? So I think we get really stuck in our mindsets and our point of view. So it's not narcissistic at all. It's actually really beneficial for how we are in the world when we kind of loosen our grip on those very rigid notions and get curious about them instead.
I like how you just described loosening your grip, because that kind of fits into this idea of perfectionism.
Oh, uh-huh.
And perfectionism is just rampant in society today. And I love that you quote James Victori, "Feck Perfection." because, you know, I've actually had a chance to have him on my podcast.
Oh, stop it. Really?
Yes. He was episode 100. Oh. I wanted to do something special. And I'm like, I love this guy. I'm going to see if he'll be on the show. And sure enough, he was.
Oh, that's and, so awesome.
Yeah, I haven't had a chance to read his new book yet, but I love his stance about giving perfection the middle finger. Because if we know that all signs point to better work when we're relaxed, when we're not tightening our grip, when we're loosening it, why do we still do it?
Yeah, I know. And he's such a rebel. He's so funny about it. I love him. I'm waiting for his book to arrive. So it should be here any day. I had one of those situations where I accidentally ordered the Kindle version, and I don't like reading on a device. I like to read paper books. So I was like, oh, what? Because I had pre-ordered it and went, darn it. So I ordered I don't know if it's paperback or hardcover, but should be here, I think, tomorrow by noon. Nice. So I think that when we get curious about ourselves and we're really honest about ourselves, mm-hmm. it's just letting the fear get the best of us, right? Like that's, right. It feels vulnerable. It's leaving our comfort zone to bring our creative work out in the world, whatever that creative work is. And I know mm-hmm. you and I both have the definition of it's not just your painting or your song, you know, it might be your any type, you know, your film or your computer work or any of that. And it just feels vulnerable. Our brains want what's safe. You know, our mm-hmm. limbic systems want our, you know, what's safe and expends the least amount of effort. And mm-hmm. taking on those big projects doesn't always fit the bill of what our mind thinks is good for us. And what I found, I don't know about you, but what I found that I was really guilty of in my perfectionism, or using perfectionism as that excuse to honor my fear rather than my creativity, was that mm-hmm. I would basically just fail ahead of time. You know, I wouldn't even try. I would say, okay, oh, it's not going to be perfect. I haven't, you know, analyzed this to death yet. So I may as well just not do it at all. And, yeah. and that was, you know, really was, it was like, it was failing ahead of time rather than mm-hmm. waiting to see if I failed or not.
Interesting.
I think the other piece is that I have kids who, you know, were recently in elementary school, and what they teach now, which I love, or at least they did in our schools, is, you know, is the growth mindset, which is also a mm-hmm. part of positive psychology. And it's more recent discovery from Carol Dweck of just how a lot of us grew up with this fixed mindset of you're born with a certain amount of talent, or, you know, like the artistic talent or creative talent, and it's just fixed. It's a fixed amount. Yeah. You're a natural, all of those kind of things, rather than honoring the work that goes into it or the discipline. And I love that in her research that they've found that, you know, the growth mindset kids have more grit and have more success because they're willing to fail, and they're not just failing ahead of time. They're not just sort of hedging their bets on what they participate in, and are just willing to be vulnerable. So mm-hmm. that's mm-hmm. my point of view on the feck perfection. And I can't wait to hear James's, because he's
I'm interested too, because as you're talking, I'm thinking about what is my relationship to perfectionism. And I think in a lot of ways, not only was it certainty, you know, to me there was that connection of if it's perfect, it's certain.
Yeah.
But then as you're talking, I'm like, well, what is it, something more than that? And I think for me, it's this idea of permission, that permission follows the threads of perfection a lot better. And it's alliterative.
Yeah. so we love it. We're going to keep that.
Exactly. But this idea of permission being, if you follow the rules, if you follow these steps, you're going to be, you know, perfect. The work is going to be perfect. But creativity is messy. Life is messy.
Yes.
You know, and get your hands dirty in the paint of life.
Exactly. And I think that, you know, just on the screen talk, you know, screens have sort of sanitized a lot of that dirt right out of our lives. Yeah. You know, we don't have to get, I've seen that with, you know, parents of handing their kids an iPad, because it's like, oh, if they're going to be outside, then, you know, who knows? It's just less, it's just cleaner or whatever. And you're going, right. Oh no, we need to bring back old fashioned childhood where we're okay to just go out there and yeah, play in mud puddles and whatnot.
Yeah. So one of the things we've talked a lot about, the good things, we've talked a little bit about the bad things, but what is something that you're still struggling with today to figure out and wrestle with?
Oh God, you know, it's perfectionism, Chris, how did you know? You know, I think for me, it's really just, it's what everything that I've talked about, you know, just wrestling with that own self-doubt. I mean, I think that's what we forget. We think that we're unique in the sense that, oh, I'm the only one who has this really mean inner critic who tells me to go home and not quit my day job. And I think that that's the wrestle, is just reminding myself that oh yeah, okay, that's just fear showing up. That's just self-doubt showing up. That's just part of the process and it's okay. And to just keep going, to continue to take action despite those freak out days. In that broaden and build, the point of positive emotions that I talked about, like part of my creative process is knowing that I've got to have like a broaden and build routine for myself. So if I wake up and I'm just having a terrible morning or my computer's been hacked. No.
Yeah.
If you have those kind of situations and you have to go do something creative in that same day or get revved up for something, you know, if you have a broaden and build routine where you listen to a great song or you do something that revs you up and gets you out of that negative state. So I joke that when I was teaching my first, it wasn't the Life Feast at the time, but it was sort of my experimental, similar to the Life Feast. I was teaching a class to about 70 coaches about 5 years ago on creativity. And it was the very first class and I was so nervous to get on the computer and talk to all these people. And I was trying to get my lighting set up. And, you know, I live in Colorado, so I have an antler lamp and it's like antler sheds that no animal dies to make the lamp. But anyway, I got into a tangle with my lamp as I was trying to light my face for this computer class, ended up nearly poking my eyelid. So like my eyes bleeding. And my class was starting in like 8 minutes and I'm just a mess. I was like, oh my God, it hurt and I've got blood and what am I going to do? So long story long, I put on my favorite songs, which was this a cappella, totally cheesy, Pitch Perfect movie soundtrack that I just love to rock out to. Not anything you would be seeing in Seattle. And that's what I did to like get myself into a better state of mind after I had this huge tangle with my stupid lamb. And the host of the coach community, she was like, wow, I thought you'd have a more deep creative process. Like we sacrificed in something or lit a candle or had a prayer. And instead for me, it was, no, I'm going to listen to Pitch Perfect and that's going to put me in a better mood. My new favorite is like a James Corden Carpool Karaoke. Like that's just, you're having a bad day. You need to do something creative. That's going to rev me up personally. So I would say that I struggle with that self-doubt, but I've got the tools now to really question what I'm feeling and not believing what I think and knowing that I honor that growth is important. You know, it's not a Disney ride. I don't want the Disney ride. So,
right.
Yeah. That was a long answer. Sorry about that,
Chris. Unless it's one of those weird dark rides that they did like back in when they first opened, like with Pinocchio and Snow White, where it's all creepy really with the black lights. then it's okay.
Those were from my childhood. Yes.
Exactly. So another question that I'm going to start asking, especially people in the creative realm, is as a creative, what has been one of your biggest obstacles with money? And how did you overcome it? Because not only do we have the inner critic when it comes to our creativity, but often we attach a dollar amount to our either scarce view of the world or abundant view of the world. Yeah. And I'm curious what have been some of your ways to overcome some obstacles.
Oh, it's such a good question. For me, it's that as a creative, I always went for the now money rather than the later money. And it'd be like, okay, I'm a copywriter and I can do a lot of marketing work. So if someone wants that now, I make time for that. And things like the Life Feast and other projects that I really want to grow, I would ignore. You know, they would be on the, you know, down on the priority list. So the shift for me has really been to honor the later money rather than just the low-hanging fruit, I guess you could say. And a big way that I've done that is to put my to again honor like my own energy and creative process and be much more in tune to that. And instead of like, so my projects used to just get the crumbs, like the last dredges of my energy. I'd say, okay, maybe I'll work on my stuff like Thursday and Friday after I did all my errands and went to the doctor or whatever. It'd be like, yeah. I was in no mood to do those projects at that point. And instead what I started doing was, you know, and I would put sort of the now money projects on my Monday, Tuesday, Wednesdays. And I just flipped it. Like I started putting my stuff first, knowing that again, with the, like the positive psychology theories, like broaden and build, when I do my own work first, I have more energy in the week to do the rest of it. So
yeah.
I actually didn't have to let go of some of that security. I just needed to switch my schedule around to make it work a lot better, if that makes sense. So that's been a big switch for me. And then I think just also knowing that in that abundant mindset, it's knowing that, you know, we create our life. We create the results of our life. Our thoughts create our life. Our actions create our life. And I'm a big believer in just taking 100% responsibility for what I have created. So when I was in the hot mess of the restaurant world, you know, that was because of choices I had made and, you know, actions that I was taking within that. So I had the opportunity, you know, after 40 to create a different life for myself. So if we want to create abundance, like it's not coming from that negative narrowed point of view. So how are you doing it? I would love to hear. I'm open to more suggestions.
How am I doing what?
Well, how are you, how are you overcoming obstacles with money?
Oh, that is the question I think for any creative. I know for myself, I'm for a while I was kind of in between two worlds where I was, you know, the creative aspect, but also, you know, I have aspirations to coach. I have aspirations to create my own courses. And so on one hand, I felt just even yesterday, I was kind of trapped between these two worlds.
Yeah.
And then this morning I'm sitting and working, you know, in my notebook, kind of writing down my thoughts. And the question that I ask people lately is about, you know, instead of the slashes, what is the thread? And that really brought that perspective to myself. So instead of worrying about, okay, you know, I need to raise money and I'm moving this way, so I can't look for money the other way. And really it's like, okay, what is the thread that, who am I in all of the different things that I do, and attach the value to that,
yeah,
and not the action.
Oh, I love that. It's such, so not that binary approach of just,
right. Yeah,
it's either or, and this is a do or die situation. Yeah. Yeah.
But I mean, I'm still going to struggle through figuring out the dollar amount to the value. And I mean, that's the never ending dance for me. But I think instead of worrying about, okay, am I going to find a job in this area, that area, that area, project, I can take a breath. I can kind of be like, okay, you know, where do I show up? How do I show up? What does that look like?
Yeah. And kind of the curious question, like, what's another way of looking at that? Or how can I, you know, one I love to use is, how can I surprise myself this month with how I'm going to do this? And I would say the other area, the obstacle with that, with money, that I am actively using to overcome that is really just making friends with that failure piece again of, and not saying, you know, to me, the definition of failure is just that if you quit, you know, if you give up, and instead saying, okay, well, I'm going to figure it out. So I just need to just figure out which way works and which way doesn't, and just keep going. So I kind of have, as I've mentioned several times, like I really respect, you know, or value leaving my own comfort zone. So if I come up with 25 different ways I'm going to leave my comfort zone in my creative business to make more money in it, make more offers that might feel vulnerable or scary to get possibly rejected. I kind of have a little more fun with it than I did in the past, you know, of saying, oh, okay, it's sort of like the failure game. Like, you can check this one off. I tried this person and they said no, or they said yes, or whatever, rather than taking it all so personally, because I think that's actually was a big obstacle as well for me, was just thinking of oh, if it wasn't happening easily, that must be really personal. And that was so silly.
I love that connection too, because, you know, people say it's not personal, it's business. And it's just like, we're getting to the age where it is personal.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you have to learn to, I think, separate that value between your self-worth and the work that you do.
I was just thinking the same thing, like, but it's your own value isn't determined by that, whether it's personal or business. Like, just and I think honoring, just, you know, for all of us creatives, is that creative expression. Like, we got to do what we've got to do. I think we just can't keep it all bottled up inside.
Well, and I don't know how you are with this, but I mean, we talked a little bit about intuition earlier, and it's like, I'll kind of go between the two worlds of, okay, I'm going to read it in books and I'm going to ascertain the truth from talking to people, and I'm going to get really clear on what I offer. But then on the other hand, it's just like, what am I feeling? What am I observing? What am I seeing? What do I want to bring into this world? And so it's just like, sometimes I just feel that dichotomy.
Yes.
As opposed to, okay, I'm going to get really just filthy, dirty in between those two worlds.
Oh yeah. I'm going to just fumble and be okay with it every day.
Yeah.
It just, you know, I mean, yeah, you think about a baby learning to walk, you know, you don't, they don't do it perfectly. So, and you don't have any doubt that they're going to figure it out. So why are we so hard on ourselves when we're, you know, delving into a new creative project or new career switch or whatever that is? Like, it's okay to be a beginner.
Yeah. Well, in many ways, I mean, some of the books that I've read too is like, the beginner actually hasn't it's like the known bias or something like that, where the experts in a field can only see one way, whereas a beginner can see many ways.
Right. Like the, you know, when your cup is already full with all your knowledge, I think it's like a Buddhist parable that, you know, you're just going to overflow rather than being sort of that empty vessel. Yeah. I love the concept of wabi-sabi as well, sort of that perfectly imperfect, that it makes something more beautiful and more appealing when it's not all glossy and shiny. So I look at that with my business too. Like, it's prettier when it's messier, right?
As long as it brings confidence to you, and then the clients and customers connect to that confidence, I think then it can be as messy as you want.
Yes.
I think I'm just putting it together right now. I'm just talking from this place of just like, huh, okay. It all comes down to confidence.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, but confidence, and also I think just that authenticity too, of just, I think we're more, I think in this curated world that we're living in now, that it is appealing to, you know, maybe not a total hot mess, but just to roll with the imperfections a little bit more rather than, you know, producing it all to death.
That's definitely something that, as I've worked on this podcast, when I originally started, you know, I wanted to edit everything down. So, I mean, you go back to some of the early interviews and I was editing everything down. I'm like, oh, that's an I'm going to take that out. I would try to take out every ums and likes and so's and all these things. Whereas, you know, it took the soul, it took the humanity out of the interview to the point where now it's like, okay, if there's a gap or if there's a really clear edit, I'll make it and give the authenticity of the moment, but, you know, shorten it
right
without removing the authenticity. But it's not something that I read in a book, it's something that I had to experience and go through,
right? Of like, this doesn't sound relatable, this is just a little too perfect. So
yeah
I love that.
It all comes back to perfection, doesn't it?
Right. It does. There it is. Feck perfection. We all love a good blooper reel, don't we? Like that's makes
right.
us laugh and connect. And
we, my wife and I were just watching Meet the Parents and Meet the Fockers recently. And the most enjoyable parts of those movies were the gag reels.
Oh yeah. Where they're laughing at themselves in the middle yeah. of it, like a Saturday Night Live skit. Like, oh
yeah.
yeah. It really is. So see, we put all that pressure on ourselves for nothing. So
so I don't think that you have a problem thinking bigger, but what are some of the ways that you force yourself to think bigger, not only in your work, but in your life?
Oh, gosh, I think, you know, I feel like I'm going to sound like a broken record. You know, it's just all those same pieces. Mm-hmm. You know, when I think it was, I don't know, probably like 15 years, 12 years or so ago, I had a friend who was asked all of her friends. She was working with an editor of a book published by Random House on, you know, it was like other people's rejection letters. And it was, you know, if you'd gotten rejected by a lover or a college or a job or anything, would you give this letter to the book and have it included? And I remember I wrote her back and I thought, well, that would actually be really fun to participate in, but I don't have any rejection letters. And I said, and it's not because I'm not worthy of being rejected. It's because I don't think I've put myself out there enough. And I said, I'd be really interested in seeing like the person who's able to submit the most rejection letters to your book project, you know, where their success was in life. And the editor, the main editor of the book, loved my email so much and asked if he could publish that in it. So I don't have any rejection letters, but that's because I've just rejected in myself. You know, it's just always been these very calculated risks that weren't really risks.
Yeah.
And so he wrote the whole foreword of the book on it. And so that's just a big piece of mine, as you can hear, it's that thinking bigger is making peace with that rejection and that failure. One of my favorite examples from the book when it did finally come out was like this artist had gotten rejected from all these galleries, tons of them. And he had made these beautiful paintings over the rejection letters, like that. So you can still read the letter, but there's this really cool drawing on top of it. And then, you know, in the perfect fairy tale, fate got this incredible art show of the rejection letters with the paintings on top of them.
Wow.
So, you know, for me, it's just being open to that serendipity of it all, of just thinking like I have this plan, you know, back in my restaurant days when I would try to control the uncontrollable and going, oh my God, when I open myself up to what else is in store, there's so much more than what I imagined. So there's, you know, thinking bigger, I think is just being open to that possibility and knowing that I might just like bump right into it.
It makes me think of that, what was the phrase, broaden and build,
yes.
that you can't broaden and build without some sort of rejection.
Right. Yeah. I mean, if you're just living this sheltered life under the covers, you know, you're not going to get very far with it. It's not going to be very meaningful. You'll be very well versed in all of Netflix and that would be a whole new party trick.
This has been an amazing conversation, Lizzie.
Oh.
I'm just like blown away by just what you've shared, what you've experienced, all the ways that you've shown up. And the last question that I have for you is, what was the last book or podcast that blew your mind?
Oh, okay. So I feel like I'm totally busting on Netflix, so I shouldn't share anything from
Go for it.
I shouldn't out myself on any movie. No, I'm just kidding. So obviously Getting Work to Work is my new favorite, but
yes.
Yeah, of course. Duh. I'm so going to go listen to that James Victoria episode. I didn't.
GWTW.co/100.
Perfect. I am heading there right after this. I would say, you know, what's really kind of blown my mind is, I don't know if you're familiar with The Armchair Expert with Dax Shepard. That's so he's, you know, he's a comedian and an actor and, you know, he's been in some pretty shallow movies, and he has this wonderful podcast that he interviews like stars to like positive psychology researchers. So, you know, I absolutely love the Armchair Expert. It's so random. Like my favorites would be sort of John Gottman all on relationships to like Sarah Silverman being really irreverent. I have very random taste, and Dax apparently does too. And he's also from Michigan, where I grew up. So that's
nice.
That's my favorite. That's my most recent mind blowing. Besides a movie I was thinking of that I thought, well, I can't bust myself up.
Uh oh, what movie was it?
It was I think it was actually when I was supposed to do the first podcast with you, and I had to cancel because I was sick, and I watched Life Itself on it was on Amazon Prime. Oh, it was that one sticks with you. There are too many spoilers. I would say it's very much that whole the thread of all of this of just life can, you know, can get all lifey on you. It's the characters go through all kinds of resilient tests, and it's just beautifully done. It was a good one.
Well, Lizzie, where can people learn more about you apart from listening to this full awesome interview?
Apart from, they're probably like, I'm so tired of her. So you can find me at LaRockstarCreative.com. That's my website. And on there, you can have
best URL ever.
I was going to say, you can have all my alliterative courses on there. I'll have to think of new ones now. I'm laughing at myself. And on social media, where I try to be, you know, vigilant about not spending too much time on, but I'm still there. Instagram's my favorite, being a photographer. So, and that's just at LaRockstar.
Nice. Well, Lizzie, thank you so much for being a guest on Getting Work to Work. It's been fabulous to talk to you. And my day is so full and bright and amazing. Aww. And awe-inspiring now because of you. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Likewise. This has been a huge pleasure. So thank you so much for having me, Chris.
Before we wrap up this episode of Getting Work to Work, I want to leave you with two questions. What big idea are you chasing, and how are you bringing it to life? Reach out and let me know. I'm Chris at ChrisMartinStudios.com, or you can find me on Twitter and Instagram. I'm at CM Studios. I really do love hearing from people, so if you need someone to share your ideas with or need encouragement, reach out and say hello. There are a lot of podcasts you could be listening to, and I am very grateful that you would spend valuable time listening to Getting Work to Work. Would you be willing to spread the word about the show with your friends, other creative entrepreneurs and leaders who want to get their work to work? You can send them to gwtw.co to access all 260 episodes, as well as find the links to stream the show on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, and more. You may have noticed a theme in this podcast that I love talking about curiosity, but did you know I also like writing about it too? Each week I release my curiosity thoughts in the Curiosity Lab. You can sign up for it today at the bottom of the show notes page at gwtw.co/260. And I also recently released an email series for creative entrepreneurs who may be struggling with burnout, conformity, and mediocrity called The Curiosity Killers. Head to curiositykillers.com to learn more about this resource and sign up for this fun and serious look at why curiosity matters. Until next time, may creativity and curiosity fuel your life.